Chances are you haven't heard of Banjo Morton, but he's certainly someone who deserves recognition. And on Night Arc Week, why not let's shine a little light on someone who stood up for his rights and inspired others to do so too. After 11 years of perseverance, award-winning documentary filmmaker Lara Damiani has released Banjo Morton, The Untold Story. It's a free multimedia interactive website and it tells the story of his experience and the many times that he stood up for his values and culture. I was lucky enough to have Lara drop into the studio earlier in the week to talk to me about her experience as a documentary filmmaker in general and specifically why we need to know about Banjo. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
My name is Lara Damiani and I'm a documentary filmmaker. The type of work I do, it's very purpose-driven. So all my work is very much around social issues. And so, for example, the project you're going to be talking to me about is an Indigenous-based project. But, you know, I do projects, I've done a lot of work for NGOs around the Asia-Pacific region. I worked with Adelaide's Australian of the Year, Dr. James Mukin. We made a documentary which is going through some film festival circuit at the moment about his voluntary work and his foundation called Sight for All. So I guess very sort of social issues, purpose driven work is the basis of what I do. And yeah,
that's fantastic. What's your story that brought you to right now?
I have quite a diverse and interesting background. I got into documentary filmmaking not that long ago, and I came to it with no formal training whatsoever. So just before I was documentary filmmaking, I was working for myself as a freelance writer and editor. I had always had a passion for stories and particularly documentaries, and a really good friend of mine had studied film at Flinders, and we then started working together on some small local projects. But she taught me the basics of, you know, video recording and sound recording and interviewing. And I remember it was sort of getting into the year 2007 and the Beijing Olympics were coming up and I thought, I really want to make a documentary about Tibet, because it was always an issue and a country and a place and a historical perspective that had always interested me from the point of view of its occupation by China. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to go and make this documentary. And I did. That was my first project. So I made a documentary about Tibet.
Just a little undertaking.
Yeah. It was actually quite a big thing. I went into Tibet. I had three trips into India. I got to interview the Dalai Lama, which was amazing. And it was from that documentary I actually managed to get a story on Channel 9, and Kerry Armstrong, the actress, saw it. I had no funding for this project, and she saw it, and eventually sort of we made contact and she donated her time and narrated that for me. And an amazing friendship happened and we kept in touch, and she then ended up narrating another small project that I made.
That's amazing in terms of the timing in 2007 would have been very interesting to go and explore. Like, I'm just trying to recall what that sort of next lot of dates were, where the monks were moving out of their big enclaves there, and there was a lot of like immolation protests and things like that.
Yeah, it was sort of around that 2007, yeah. Particularly in the lead up to the Beijing Olympics.
Yeah.
So there were quite a few instances of the sort of self-immolation, and some of the monks were, you know, were using that, trying to find that global spotlight to protest the cause. And I remember going in 2007 and under the guise of tourists, and a good friend of mine who was a photographer came along with me, and, you know, we pretended we were a honeymoon couple. That was our story. But the thing that was most obvious to me was how, I guess, Sinofied it really was. And so we went into Lhasa and, you know, the street names were not Tibetan anymore. You know, all the street signs were Chinese. We managed to go into some areas outside of Lhasa. But it was just, you know, that sense of a lot of control. There were a lot of sort of military with guns and soldiers with guns. And there was an incident I remember once where we left Lhasa and we were driving out in the morning, and I was filming in the car, and I was filming a soldier on a bridge, and the same afternoon returning on the same bridge, they stopped the car And I really thought they were going to confiscate all my gear, but they were asking us via the translator what I was filming. And I just made up a story that I was filming the mountains. And, you know, it was probably only a few minutes, but it did feel like quite some time. And they eventually let us go. But, so it was, there was a lot of military presence at that time.
Yeah. Were you... Do you think it was a bit of a naivety in terms of, like, going and sort of trying to fake it through there in terms of what the implications perhaps of being caught would have been?
I was quite aware of what the implications would have been, and I had sort of made that promise to myself that if anything happened, in fact, I thought it would be even better for my documentary, so I was quite prepared to. But I did think that, I didn't think that there would be anything major happening, but I was prepared in case it did.
It seems pretty gutsy, especially for your first time out, to just go, all right, I'm not jumping in sort of halfway to this documentary thing. I'm going all the way in and sneaking my way into Tibet.
I tend to do things like that.
I'm very impressed. I love this. I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about your Banjo Morton Untold Story project. And before we went on air, you were mentioning that a long while ago, when Radio Adelaide was in a completely different site, you were speaking to one of our previous presenters when you were formulating this at the beginning of the project. So how long has this particular project been going?
It began in 2010, so it's been a while. It started back then. I'd read an article in The Age about this man called Banjo Morton, who was a Liawara, senior Liawara man from Central Australia, who was part of this walk-off in 1941. And I was so intrigued that I made contact with I found out the details for Banjo's nephew, Richard Downs, and I made contact with him. And we had this huge conversation. I had just told Richard about, you know, what I'd done with the Tibet documentary, which was released a couple of years back. And then Richard invited me to go out and meet Banjo. And it was March 2010. I found a way. I had to fly to Alice Springs, hire a car, drive out to Central Australia, to his country. And that was the first time I met Banjo and heard his story.
Was that the first time you'd been out somewhere so remote?
In Australia, yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, and it would have been quite remarkable to have gone essentially on invitation, because that's one thing that's very important, isn't it, is establishing proper connections when you want to walk into a community and ask questions.
Absolutely. And for me, from day one, that was always the most important thing. And because I got invited by Banjo out to his home country, so not just the community, which is sort of the prescribed area, but honeymoon ball, and there is a language name for it, you know, that's where we met, his father's country. So we were literally sitting down in the dirt with nothing but just sort of red earth and trees around us.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, Banjo's a spectacularly interesting man, which is why you've created this wealth of work about him. What was he like when you met him?
When I first met Banjo, he had this incredible, beautiful sense of humility, and he was just this lovely... I think I said it once in an interview, you know, this amazing man in the middle of nowhere who doesn't really have much, but has achieved this amazing, something so amazing and so historical that very few people knew about. But it was his wonderful, just, you know, very lovely sense of humility.
I hadn't heard of Banjo when I came across your storytelling, and I was so surprised. I've reported about First Nations peoples here in Australia for a lot of years, and yet Banjo's story was new to me. And it's such a significant story, and particularly because he's taken a stand, not just a significant stand, not just once, but a few times in his life, to really stand up for the rights of his people, for listeners, can you please just give me a I know it's a detailed history and people can access more through the site that you've made, but if you can give me a bit of background on him, that'd be great.
Sure. So in 1949, Banjo and a handful of other Aboriginal stockmen walked off from where they were working, which was the Lake Nash cattle station, because they were getting paid in rations, and they decided that they wanted to be paid wages, like every other worker in Australia at the time. So they went on strike. The strike wasn't long-lived. Unlike, you know, Kalkarindji, Wave Hill, which was a really big strike, but it was a successful strike. So they actually did receive wages as a result of that. And then almost 60 years later, when the federal government's intervention came in, Banjo decided that he wanted to walk off again, I guess in form of another strike, protesting their dismay and absolute distrust with what was happening with the intervention. So they did that again. And what they did in 2009, the second time, was they walked off again from Umbladawatch, which is the prescribed community, and went to set up life, I guess, in a way, in at Honeymoon Bore, which is a sort of a small piece of land about 3 kilometres away from the community.
It was really struck me that the parallels of the experience that he had in both of those instances, where when it came to the stolen wages, essentially, prior to that he was only getting paid in rations, you know, in that sort of flour, you know, water, the product to make his meals for the day. And then the proposal of the intervention essentially were putting people on basics cards, which was a return to pay, you know, your entitlements, but only being paid in rations. And it would have been quite devastating for him to have travelled 50 years in his life and worked very hard during those years and then gone, hang on, we're being put back in the same position again. We've had this fight. Did he talk with you about that?
Sure. Something he said that was really powerful when I was recording him when he was talking, he said, you know, we feel like a mob of cattle herded up and we want to be living free on our own land. And that was something that really struck me, and I really thought about that in depth, and I thought, how must Banjo and his family and that community and the rest of the people that were all being affected by what was happening under the intervention, how must they be feeling? And I guess that's why, for me, one of the reasons why I persevered so long and so hard with this project, because I felt that it was a really important project. It had a lot of important messages to send. And even more specifically for Banjo, because I always knew when I first met Banjo, it was just this such a wonderful man. And I always knew I wanted to, because he trusted me to share his story, I wanted to make sure that one day I would find a way to be able to do that. So that was really important.
For anyone listening, you've structured this documentary project as a website. You travel through the issues and the stories that relate to Banjo's life, but also the circumstance of his people. And the way it's structured, it kind of talks about those two walk-offs, but then dives further into the colonial experience, the dream time and culture and history. Was that structure always clear to you in the way that you would talk about Banjo's life?
Not at all. No, not at all. And what happened was, originally my idea was to make an animated documentary. So I wanted to recreate Banjo's historical walk-off through animation, and the idea was it was going to be a feature. I had this massive plan, it was fairly grand plan, and I had to spend a lot of time just building that relationship and going out to Umbladawatch and spending time with Banjo and his family. So I was trying to find ways over a number of years to do that, and that was happening. But a lot of that in the beginning, I didn't have any funding, or I had to find other projects to fund me to sort of, you know, to get up there doing other work. So anyway, that was sort of this hodgepodge way of getting up there, but building the relationship. And once I realised that I was not going to find the level of funding I needed to make an animated documentary because animation is so expensive. I had to rethink how I could do this, and I had started exploring multimedia documentary websites, and I really felt that they were a perfect platform to tell Banjo's story. But not only Banjo's story, but sort of, as you said, you know, delving into these wider issues, political, social issues, cultural issues that affect sort of Indigenous Australia. And so I was then lucky enough to get some funding through the Indigenous Languages and Arts Program back in 2019, which would allowed me to engage writers and researchers who actually helped me come up with that entire structure and design that sort of content map, and then engage a designer and put the whole project together.
Now, you've got so much in there. There's old documentation that must have been dug up from archive. There's sort of, you can click through to additional detail on particular issues. And you've also got a combination of both video and audio material that is all of the people talking about the circumstance of the time. To what degree is that audio and video recording stuff that you captured while you were there?
Most of the video recording on the site is mine. Bits and pieces belonged or I sourced from other people who had been out. So, for example, when Protest House, which is the name that Banjo gave to the house that was built in protest at Honeymoon Boyne protest of the intervention, I wasn't there. I couldn't get up there at that time. So someone else happened to be there and I found out who that person was and I managed to get some footage from them. So, and then there was some archival material which I got from the archives in Alice Springs. And in fact, a little interesting story about the archives in Alice Springs is when I first went up there in 2011, I discovered the Lake Nash Police Journal, and that is the journal that actually had evidence of the walk-off. And so the Constable Jack Marnie, who was the policeman in charge of the Lake Nash cattle station and surrounding areas at the time, had documented that. And I then got in touch with his daughters, who I'm still in touch with, who have provided me with a number of sort of images of the day and of the, from that time, I should say. So that police journal was interesting, and it relates back to one of your comments before about not knowing about Banjo. I contacted the historian, the leading historian in the Northern Territory, Peter Forrest, at the time, and I said, look, I've just uncovered this thing. Did you know about this walk-off? And he didn't know anything about it, and he was really intrigued. And I guess that was also another thing that really gave me that inspiration to really want to find a way to get Banjo's story out there.
If you just tuned into Festival City, I'm speaking with Lara Damiani. She is the documentary filmmaker and the person behind pulling together a fantastic free multimedia interactive website, Banjo Morton, The Untold Story. We talked earlier about the time that it's taken you to realise this project and some of its funding, but a lot of it is also that it takes time to build trust. Communities have been used over time. You know, people have come in anthropologically and all of that to investigate and try and get stories from people. And I wouldn't be surprised if people are a bit reluctant to open up and share.
Yeah.
Did it take that time for you to essentially establish a relationship of trust that enabled people to realise that you are 100% behind the good intention behind this, not just a blow through, essentially?
I absolutely understand what you're saying, and you're absolutely right. Yes, it did. And I always knew that from the start that I would have to be investing a lot of time, because for me, I was very genuine and very authentic about this. I guess also on my side and to my favour was I established a really good relationship with Richard Downs, who is Banjo's nephew. And Richard's father was Irish. His mother was Banjo's sister. Richard sort of traverses beautifully in both, you know, white fella and black fella lands. And so Richard, I think, possibly was a really good advocate for me. So I guess that was interesting. I had this great advocate, but, you know, I did invest a lot, and I think people knew that I wasn't just another blow-in that was coming in to get a story and then sort of run away. And I'm still in touch with the family. I'm still in touch with the community. I'm waiting for the next chance to go out there. In 2019, unfortunately, Banjo passed away, and I went up to attend his funeral, you know. So I still have that connection, and I always will, with his family and the community, and that's really important for me.
The website, it tells the story of the Aliawarra, particularly how through colonisation in the area, other nations were essentially moved out of spaces, particularly around Lake Nash. Like there was a different nation that lived on that country before, and then told their story to the Aliwara peoples, who then took over custodianship of it. Those sort of nuanced stories aren't always told and really clearly understood, particularly, I think, by white fellas. And sharing that through this kind of medium where people can slowly read it, understand it, hear different evidence of it, it really does highlight those stories and I guess break through in a new way in terms of those realisations of how the human movement and changes impacted peoples there. In what way were you considering the way to tell that story in terms of ensuring that that kind of penny drop moment happens for people?
I think it was really important for this project that really, as much as possible for me, it wasn't my story. I was just the platform through which this story could be shared to the rest of the world. And so for me, it was always really important to keep Banjo's perspective at the forefront. This may be sort of a quite generic response to your question, but also was really important for me because I come from parents who were migrants from Italy, and they came from a country where there are also very different regions who speak very different dialects, and the people in the north are very different from the people in the south. So I always grew up with a real understanding of what it means to live in a country with kind of separate countries in a way, which is why sort of Indigenous Australia always intrigued me, and I always felt this kind of little connection and sort of really wanted to learn more and understand more. And so roundabout answer to your question is what was really important in this project too was to convey that sense that a lot of people in Australia still don't understand, and which I really would love them to, is that when you talk about an Aboriginal Australian or an Indigenous Australian, you need to talk about them from the perspective of their country and where they're from. That there were so many hundreds of Indigenous languages. Many of those are now have disappeared or are at risk of disappearing. But the ones that are left, you look at a map of the original countries, the original Indigenous nations of Australia, and you really get a sense of how different it is and how different it is for different people from different language groups and different country groups. And so I think that then was really important to bring across in the project and have people really grasp a better understanding of what it means to be, yes, you're an Aboriginal Australian or an Indigenous Australian, but within that sort of, I guess, overarching umbrella are all the differences that make up the different sort of groups.
I do think that education has come a long way. I was at high school when the Mabo decision happened, and it's been really interesting watching the progress or lack of progress at different stages on First Nations rights here in Australia. But I feel like my children are getting better information now. Do you think that's true too?
If you compare it to, you know, when I was at school, absolutely, yeah. But I was at school a long time ago. I think so. I think there's still work to be done, but yeah. I think it's absolute. Like you said, it's great that these conversations can happen. I wish more of these conversations would happen. And the fact that, yes, we are, education provides so many more perspectives these days is great. You know, this is fantastic. And it's also so important. Another reason behind making an educational resource was, you know, I understand the importance of inspiring, motivating, sort of raising awareness at that sort of school level. And hence, you know, that's it's kind of exciting that this is going to be in schools and teachers are picking it up already. So
it's so good. I was flicking through the last few days and my son sort of, what's that you're looking at? And so I was sort of talking to him and telling him, this amazing man I've discovered, you know. And I welcomed the opportunity through this project to sort of be able to sit with my son. Do you connect out to other resources?
There is a section on the website, Want to Know More, and so there's a whole heap of links that will take you to different areas. What's recently been happening is I've been talking with Cool Australia. So Cool Australia is a really excellent website. They're a national platform that a lot of teachers use to access educational resources. They develop resources according to a specific template they have, which is really great and designed very much for teachers with no prior knowledge of a particular area. So when I reached out to them about Banjo Morton, The Untold Story, they got so excited. They said, oh, let's collaborate. Can we, you know, we really want to share this. We want to develop some additional learning resources. So we've just put in a funding application recently and hoping that we can get some more additional learning resources developed and then distributed through their very big national teacher network.
That's fantastic because, you want the people in the classrooms to be able to talk to it and sort of unpack the issues that relate to it.
Exactly, exactly. And also not to have that fear of using the resources if they don't have any prior knowledge. And I think that's what the resources with Cool Australia will do, will give teachers that confidence to be able to use it.
I loved also that you did manage to get a bit of animation in. I think in the artist profiles that you created around the artwork, works that are made on country. That was quite lovely. Tell me about the production of those.
Yeah, that was so great. That was a project. So another really strong relationship I developed as a result of working on this project was with the Art Centre in Umblatawatch. So they produce beautiful artworks. And 1 year together, the Art Centre and I, through their wonderful manager, Caroline Hunter, we applied for some federal funding to produce a series of videos about some of the artists. And I always wanted to include some animation in the videos. So I worked with wonderful colleagues of mine from Cuddle Cuddle Studio who did the illustrations and animations that sort of represented some of the artists. So as you said, you saw there were sort of little sections of animation which were quite beautiful. And those videos are used by the Art Centre to promote the artists at, you know, the Darwin Art Fair and all sorts of places. But that's an example of a project where, you know, I worked with the Art Centre and I went out and spent time there. But then while I was there, I just spent another week or two and you know, sat with Banjo and did some more filming there. So
these are all of the side hustles that you managed to accomplish the whole thing. I love the creativity in accessing the opportunity. And I think that that sort of persistence and perseverance really is what's needed to make these kinds of resources. I mean, obviously you've done it, you've persevered and through passion and belief in your project, but I imagine it would feel like a massive mountain to climb for somebody who's either starting out or, you know, so at times doesn't have the resources to be able to necessarily fund something for themselves. Would you have advice for people who are trying to take on such ambitious projects and tell really important stories in how to engage and how to sort of make it a success?
Yeah, it is tricky. And I guess that's where, you know, a lot of perseverance. And I mean, you know, there were so many times where I was ready to give up and I just could not see this project being finished or sort of finding any money to finish it. But for some really, I don't know what it was, some cry, just kept thinking of that first time I met Banjo and I thought, no, I've got to do this, I've got to do this. And then I just also, I think I became patient. I learnt a lot of patience. And I think maybe that's what Banjo taught me. I mean, he was so patient. And I think once you understand that things don't just happen quickly, things take time, and good things take a lot of time, that's really important. And I guess the other advice is, yes, those side hustles are great. So, you know, if you can be creative thinking about where you can strategically find funding or find ways to fund yourself to do something, but then always look for those additional opportunities to just invest a little bit of your time where you can.
What was the funding that you ended up securing?
Yeah, the funding was through the Commonwealth Government's Indigenous Languages and Arts Program. Mm. So it's, I'm sure it's a Prime Minister's department.
Right, okay. Yeah. And that was sort of aligned, because 2019 was the year of Indigenous Languages. So I guess your focus, and there's so much beautiful language in this project, listening to it was really lovely to hear it spoken. Were you able to highlight that and sort of say that you're bringing not just a story but language to the fore?
Absolutely. That was part of the whole application was, thinking strategically about where could there be some funding and who would be interested in this type of project. So that was the perfect opportunity. Mm. And the language component, of course, was always a really important one.
The project is launched. Have the family seen it and have you heard what they think about it?
Yeah, yeah. The family have seen it because that was one of the last things I did was I made sure I went through an approval process so that everyone got a chance to see it and was happy with all the content, that there were no issues with what was in there. So everyone's really happy. I'm waiting for an opportunity to go up there so we can have an official launch in the community. But Northern Territories, well, Alice Springs just gone into lockdown. So I'm hoping that maybe next month or the month after we can really officially celebrate this as a community. And now I'm looking for more funding to do some outreach and distribution, and I'm hoping to do an official launch here in Adelaide. Richard is in Adelaide, so I would like him to be there. So okay. Still some more activities and things to be done.
Oh, it's fantastic. It'll be lovely to see this sort of filter out and really reach people and get that story told.
Yeah.
I'm sure Banjo would be very, very pleased with what you've done.
I think so. I know. I always feel like he's looking down, smiling, and I think he's pretty happy.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think we're very lucky that you've captured one of the elders' stories before he passed and had some of it told in his own words and a lot of it and all of it respectively, respectfully representing his story. So congratulations and thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'll say one word. It's mura. And that is in Aliawara, that means good.
Mura.
Mura. Mura.
Lara Damiani speaking about her website that she's created with the assistance of others, but it's been a passion project to tell the story of Banjo Morton. And you can find it at banjomorton.com.au. It's certainly worth a very big look through and you'll learn something fantastic about somebody who we all should know about.